From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is Evan Fowler.
Welcome to the Monday edition of Washington Watch. Evan Fowler, as was just said, Director of Operations for Bot Radio Network, filling in for Tony today. Glad to be here. Glad you're here. Don't know what the weather's like in your part of the country, but it's snowy and wintry here in Kansas City, where this program's originating today. Lots of stuff going on, have you noticed, in the news everywhere, Washington and across the country, but particularly Washington. We're going to be talking about some of that stuff today. First of all, in a wide-ranging interview on Fox News Sunday yesterday, former FBI Director James Comey argued that the Bureau was vindicated behind the Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz's findings on the origins of the Russia investigation. But the Boy Scout admitted he was wrong about serious failures the watchdog found in the FBI surveillance process. In just a moment, I'll talk with Chris Farrell, Judicial Watch's Director of Investigations and Research. And in the second segment, both the Fifth and Sixth Circuit Courts of Appeals have ruled on abortion. Catherine Beck Johnson, FRC's Research Fellow for Legal and Policy Studies, will join me to talk about that. At the bottom of the hour, the abortion giant Planned Parenthood's brand of sexual health care will soon be within the walls of dozens of California public schools. And the Los Angeles taxpayers will be footing that bill. I'll talk with Petrina Mosley. She's FRC's Director of Life Culture and Women's Advocacy. And in the final segment, in addition to your calls, as Christians, our shopping habits should reflect wise Christian stewardship. For example, should we spend another dime at Chick-fil-A? What about the new ad featuring a lesbian kiss between two brides on the Hallmark Channel? Just found out about that one today. When lots of Christian families with small children are watching. And what about other stores as we make our Christmas purchases? I'll talk with Dr. David Black, founder of Second Vote. Well, let's get started with the first segment here in a wide-ranging interview on Fox News Sunday, which I found very frustrating to watch. I don't usually throw things at the television, but I was tempted. I just have to admit that. It's so frustrating to listen to this man weave his way around and spin things. He's really good at it. But former FBI Director James Comey argued that the Bureau was vindicated by the Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz's findings on the origins of the Russia investigation. He admitted, though, he was wrong. This is the first time he's done that, about serious failures the watchdog found in the FBI's surveillance process. Joining me with his analysis is Chris Farrell, Judicial Watch's Director of Investigations and Research. Chris, welcome to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you. Thanks very much.
Did you get a chance to watch that whole interview yesterday, by the way?
I forced myself. I had to be strapped down in a chair, my eyelids held up. Yes.
Oh, wow. Amazing. I mean, I would recommend to our listeners that they go back and watch that. It gives you a real good look into who Jim Comey has become. Well, anyway, I want to play a key side-by-side comparison from that interview between former FBI Director James Comey and Inspector General Michael Horowitz on the contrast of how the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that's FISA, we've been hearing FISA all over the place, application was executed. It's followed by the well-publicized exchange between Chris Wallace, host of Fox News Sunday, and former FBI Director James Comey. Greg, let's go ahead and roll that clip.
One of his big concerns is the way the FBI handled the FISA applications and the warrants that allowed you to surveil Carter Page, who was a former foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign. Again, here is what you said about the FISA process and what the Inspector General Horowitz said this week. Take a look.
I have total confidence that the FISA process was followed and that the entire case was handled in a thoughtful, responsible way by DOJ and the FBI.
We identified significant inaccuracies and omissions in each of the four applications, 7 in the first application and a total of 17 by the final renewal application.
17 significant errors in the FISA process, and you say that it was handled in a thoughtful and appropriate way.
Yeah, he's right. I was wrong. I was overconfident in the procedures that the FBI and Justice had built over 20 years. I thought they were robust enough. It's incredibly hard to get a FISA. I was overconfident in those because he's right. There was real sloppiness. 17 things that either should have been in the applications or at least discussed and characterized differently. It was not acceptable. And so he's right. I was wrong.
What do you make of that exchange, Chris? What do you think?
Well, you know, he's not going to dispute the findings of fact. The IG was questioned specifically as to whether Mr. Comey was vindicated. The IG very expressly said no, he was not. So he's in an impossible position there. But basically he uses the defense of, well, you know, I just trusted too much. It's a typical Comey sort of passive-aggressive acknowledgement where – you know, he admits that he's wrong, but he's only wrong because he just cared too much. He was too trusting. He was too confident and faithful in the integrity of the FBI. So, you know, it's a technique for sort of distraction and guilt shifting where he makes orally, he utters the words, I was wrong, but he embroiders around them in such a way as to make himself, you know, the only thing he's really guilty of is caring too much. That's his technique.
Well, and there were, again, I would recommend our listeners take time to go back and watch that interview because it's, he's a spin master. He's a tall spin master. He's about 7 feet tall. But, you know, there were a couple of times, and I think Chris Wallace did a pretty decent job in asking him some tough questions and challenging him. And he reminded me a lot of a child with his hand sticking in the cookie jar, and you're looking at him with his hand in the cookie jar, and you're saying, your hand's in the cookie jar, you need to take it out. And he looks around as if nothing is going on or nothing's wrong. He's incapable of seeing the irony there, I think. He's just that's something that was not built into his brain for whatever reason. Well, the inspector general determined that there were, as we just heard, 17 errors and omissions in the FBI applications for surveillance of former Trump campaign aide Carter Page, including altering an email by an FBI lawyer to exclude potentially exculpatory information. And my understanding is that there was also an FBI lawyer or somebody in the process who changed the content of an email from Carter Page was somebody that was working with the CIA to Carter Page was not somebody working with the CIA. What is this? It sounds more like sloppiness. It sounds a little bit more like deception, doesn't it?
No, I take an opposing position. I think that it was deliberate and malicious in an attempt to really perpetrate a fraud on the court. The gentleman involved in this is Mr. Kleinsmith, who's an FBI staff counsel. He's the senior attorney in the National Security Division working on these sorts of counterespionage, counterintelligence, FISA warrants. He knew exactly what he was doing. Mr. Page, who I've spoken to a number of times, participated in a CIA program for what they call the legal traveler debriefing, which is when you have people who lawfully travel to a particular country, particularly one that's, an intelligence drug in sort of a denied area, someplace that we can't freely operate. These business people go on these trips, they do what they do, and then when they come home, they are debriefed on what they saw, who they talked to, where they went, all the sort of basic interrogatives. Mr. Page cooperated with those legal traveler debriefings for a period of years on multiple trips. Kleinsmith knew that. There was ample documentation showing it, and he lied. He did not want to show that Mr. Page was a cooperating participant in a CIA program to debrief business people and others who travel lawfully into Russia. And the reason why they couldn't admit that is because it would shoot a hole in the theory that somehow he was a Russian spy when, you know, arguably 180 degrees opposite is what's true. He was a guy cooperating with the CIA for sort of overt collection purposes, intelligence collection, against Russia. So you can't have it both ways. And so the position Mr. Kleinsmith was put in is that he felt, I guess, his intentions, I don't know exactly, but just based on the paper record, He altered that document in order to show that instead of cooperating with the CIA, he did not cooperate, and therefore, the warrant was justified. So it's not sloppiness. It's quite deliberate, quite malicious, and it goes to really the entire intent behind this attempt to have a soft coup, to legally, air quotes around legal, legally go after the president and try to disrupt his administration.
Now, there was another exchange between Chris Wallace and James Comey yesterday where I believe Wallace played a clip of Comey maybe from a year or two ago where he was saying that this Steele dossier, which has been proven to be totally inaccurate, and the source, the what they call the subsource, I believe, that he got this information from was wrong, and so Steele was wrong. But initially, Comey claimed that it really was just a peripheral piece of information, and they sort of tipped it over the scales. But the Horowitz investigation determined that the Steele dossier was at the center of the justification for the initial and the following FISA warrants. So, again, you know, Comey was caught in the middle of this. Well, do you remember that exchange, and what are your thoughts about it?
Well, you know, again, this is another case of the Steele dossier is a pure fabrication. It's an absolute lie from first, you know, letter to the last. The IG report is a daunting document. It's written in a really tedious way for people to read. But your listeners, if they just read seven pages, if they were to brief from page 186 to 193, the IG takes apart the Steele dossier and just shows how the whole thing, you know, is just garbage. They do it in meticulous detail. And so if there's anything you're going to read out of the entire, you know, IG document, all 400 and whatever it is, 20-some-odd pages of it, just read those seven from 186 to 193, and you'll see the IG just shred the credibility of the Steele dossier, which is the foundation piece for all the criminality engaged in by, you know, Comey, Strzok, Page, the whole laundry list of FBI bad actors.
Got just a couple of minutes left, and I've got two questions I want to throw at you. Number one, you said you've talked with Carter Page quite a bit, and, you know, I don't know, our listeners, I'm sure, across the board have followed this one way in one way or another, you know, either in detail or maybe not. But so the first question is, why did they pick Carter Page to be the target of this whole thing? And then secondly, one of the big things that the mainstream media has claimed, they've latched on to the Horowitz conclusion that there did not appear to be political bias in the opening of the investigation. But I think they missed the point entirely when you start looking at the substance of the investigation and the people involved, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and others who were clearly biased, even though they claimed not to be. So first of all, why'd they pick Carter Page? And secondly, and you've got about 30 seconds here to answer those two questions.
So Carter Page was low-hanging fruit, frankly. He's an American businessman who had travel and contact. But look, he wasn't a foreign policy advisor. That's just such an overstatement. He was a self-appointed volunteer. He didn't have a business card, a desk, a phone, or anything else with the Trump campaign. He's a guy who, in an effort to really kind of self-promote, frankly, identified himself as an advisor to the campaign. Hardly. Point two, you know, when it comes to the lack of political bias or motive, it isn't what the Inspector General is tasked to do. An Inspector General looks at the internal administrative procedures of an agency or department. They
okay,
can't
Chris,
even
got,
subpoena people who have
Chris,
got
to let you go here. We're out of time. Thank you so much. Listening to Washington Watch, Eben Fowler. We'll be right back with our next segment. Thanks for listening.
Abortion is one of the most combative and sensitive moral and political questions in America today, even among Christians. There has been a renewed effort in theological liberal Christian circles to argue that the Bible does not oppose abortion. In light of these arguments, it is crucial for Christians to know what the Bible actually says about abortion. Does the Bible teach that life begins at conception or birth? Is abortion murder? In FRC's new publication titled Biblical Principles for Pro-Life Engagement, Personhood, Scripture, and Church History, author David Claussen addresses these questions with relevant passages in the Bible that inform how a Christian should think about abortion, the question of personhood, and a survey of how prominent church leaders have interpreted these passages throughout history. Learn more by visiting frc.org/unborn. That's frc.org/unborn.
Meadow Pollock was a high school senior who was tragically gunned down during the Parkland school shooting in Florida. In an emotional and gripping FRC Speaker Series event, her father, Andrew Pollock, and education expert Max Eden discussed the tragic massacre and the politically correct policies that allowed the Parkland shooting to happen. The Southern Poverty Law Center and the Obama administration promoted a false narrative that teachers and principals were racist and couldn't be trusted to enforce rules with consequences. Instead, they argued for healing circles and restorative justice. These policies enabled a psychopathic criminal to maintain a clean background and purchase a firearm used to murder 17 people at the high school. The Obama administration forced these leniency policies into hundreds of schools, serving millions of students across America. To listen to this event and to learn more, visit frc.org/speakers. That's frc.org/speakers.
Religious liberty is one of the most important yet misunderstood issues in America. There's a growing perception that protecting religious liberty is an attempt to lawfully allow bigotry and prejudice. Therefore, Christians need to be able to articulate with greater clarity and persuasiveness why they support religious liberty. Biblical Principles for Religious Liberty, Evidence from Scripture and Church History, is a new publication from Family Research Council that presents biblical and theological arguments for why religious liberty is worth defending and encourages Christians to engage in the fight to preserve America's first freedom. This publication presents key biblical texts that support a broad understanding of religious freedom and key theological arguments based on those texts. In an increasingly secular world, Christians must understand and advocate for religious liberty. Learn more by visiting frc.org/belief.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler with Bot Radio Network filling in today for Tony Perkins. Great music of the season there, bringing us back in. By the way, you know, the full House is going to vote on impeachment, I think, Wednesday. If you have thoughts about that and you want to contact your House member, the number is 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. It's a lot of fun to give their offices a call and just respectfully express your opinion and your thoughts. Well, both the Fifth and Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals have ruled on abortion. That's what we're going to be talking about in this segment. Joining me now is Catherine Beck Johnson. She is Family Research Council's Research Fellow for Legal and Policy Studies. Catherine, welcome to the broadcast today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Evan.
All right, we're going to try to squeeze a lot of information into just a few minutes here. So first of all, let's talk about the Sixth Court of Appeals ruling. Let me explain it here briefly. In October, a divided panel of the Sixth Court barred the state of Ohio from enforcing its law that prohibits medical providers from performing an abortion if they have, and this is the language from the ruling, quote, knowledge that the pregnant woman is seeking the abortion in whole or in part because her baby has been diagnosed as having Down syndrome. Tell us the news from that ruling at this point.
That's correct. So a panel of three judges struck that down. It was a divided panel. And the Sixth Circuit en banc, which is all of the judges on the Sixth Circuit, just voted to vacate that panel's ruling, which struck down Ohio's law, and has said that we're going to vacate that ruling and we're going to hear it en banc. So once again, the case will be heard before the Sixth Circuit, but this time it'll be before all of the judges of the Sixth Circuit.
And what were some of the key findings in that ruling?
Well, the majority essentially said that the state has no business limiting any abortion before viability, and therefore this bill is unconstitutional. But I think what was of particular note was Judge Batchelder's dissent. She talked about how the state has a compelling interest in preventing abortion from becoming a tool of modern-day eugenics. And that's what this bill did. She also went on to say that Ohio concluded that permitting these doctors to become accomplices to the deliberate targeting of Down syndrome babies undermines the very principle that the Down syndrome population is equal in value and dignity. She talked about how other countries have basically become successful from eliminating anybody with Down syndrome in their country by abortion, and how Ohio really wanted to restrict that. And so this idea of really noting the link between eugenics and abortion is something that's becoming very popular in circuit court opinions.
That's great. Now, when will the oral arguments take place for the entire court, the en banc court?
That date has not been set, but we're hoping it's in the next few months.
Very good. All right, let's move on to the Fifth Circuit. Turning our attention now, that's the New Orleans-based Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. It ruled that a Mississippi ban on abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy was unconstitutional. Let me ask you first, if you know the background here, why did they pick the 15th week of pregnancy?
That's something that Mississippi decided. They said that they had some doctors, and actually, in fact, one of their doctors did testify that they were able, that the unborn child was able to feel pain at 15 weeks. That's something the district court said that they weren't going to take into account because it didn't matter. There was no basis for restricting a woman's right to abortion pre-viability.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the outgoing governor, Phil Bryant, reacted to the ruling, and how did he react to that?
Well, I think that's a lot of disappointment that, you know, the court, once again, the Fifth Circuit said that there is no reason to restrict abortion pre-viability. But again, what is of note with the Fifth Circuit opinion isn't as much the opinion as it is Judge Ho's concurrence. Now, Judge Ho was a President Trump appointee, and he started his concurrence by saying there's no basis for abortion in the Constitution. However, under Supreme Court precedent, he's forced to agree with the majority's opinion. But he goes on to lament about abortion jurisprudence, and he specifically talks about the district court, Judge Reeves, who's a President Obama appointee's particular words in this case. Judge Reeves talks about how Mississippi was just, quote, bent on controlling women and minorities and, quote, disregarding their rights as citizens. And Judge Ho talked about how deeply troubling it was to see a federal court disparage the millions of Americans who believe in the sanctity of life as just nothing more than, quote, bent on controlling women and minorities. Again, he talked about, if we want to talk about minorities and abortion, let's talk about the link between eugenics and minorities and abortion. So as I said, this is something that's really coming up in a lot of circuit opinions, is these judges, and even Justice Thomas talked about it in one of his concurrences, is just the role abortion plays in eugenics.
Now, there have been a number of cases talked about, including this one, or this particular bill about 15th week of pregnancy, the ban. A number of people talking about various litigation that could be taken to the Supreme Court. Is this the best case, if it turns out that it ends up going to the Supreme Court, is this the best case to take there to in an attempt to overturn Roe?
I actually think the Sixth Circuit, the Down syndrome ban is particularly interesting because the Seventh Circuit struck down the Down syndrome ban, and the Supreme Court in that said that they weren't going to take this case because there's not a circuit split currently on the matter. And so if we're hopeful that the Sixth Circuit is going to uphold this law since they vacated the decision that struck it down. And so this could provide the circuit split that the Supreme Court seemed to be looking for to start to chip away at Roe, to say that there are reasons pre-viability to look into protecting the unborn child. So I think that's particularly interesting.
Okay, final question here. The Lieutenant Governor, Tate Reeves, is going to be the incoming Mississippi governor to replace Governor Bryant. What's his view? Is he pro-life, and is he prepared to continue the fight here?
That's certainly something that we hope, that he's willing to take on this fight, and that this is something that Mississippi continues to be pro-life. I know Reeves is a Republican, and so hopefully he is going to stand by the pro-life values. And one more note, it is of particular importance, just the role that these judges play. And, you know, as I said, Judge Ho is a President Trump appointee, just the impact of elections. And in the Sixth Circuit, actually, six out of the I believe, 15 judges who decided to hear this en banc, our President Trump appointee, so almost
That's
one-third
right.
of the Sixth Circuit. So that does go to show just how important these elections are.
Catherine Beck Johnson, thanks very much. Well, you're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler here, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, the abortion giant Planned Parenthood's brand of sexual health care will soon be within the halls of dozens of California public schools. We'll talk about that when we get.
The topic of sexual sin can be difficult to discuss in the church, but it's something that needs to be addressed. To help inform this conversation, FRC has a new publication for church leaders called Safeguard Your Ministry from Moral Failure. In it, Dr. Jesse Gill, a licensed psychologist, specifically addresses sexual sin and the susceptibility of those in church leadership. He discusses the contributing factors to moral failure, a practical understanding of our sexual nature, and a call for Christian leaders to increase their dependency on Christ. The principles found in this publication will instruct leaders in meeting their emotional, relational, and even sexual needs in healthy ways so that there will be less of a foothold for temptation. Safeguard Your Ministry for Moral Failure is a must-read for everyone involved in church ministry. To read the publication and learn more, visit frc.org/safeguard. That's frc.org/safeguard.
Are you a parent of a school-aged child? If so, then you understand that navigating your educational system is one of the biggest challenges facing families across the United States today. Family Research Council's new publication titled The SPLC's Teaching Tolerance, What Parents, Teachers, and Administrators Need to Know, helps parents identify and monitor a specific agenda that is being pushed on their children in public schools. The highly partisan left-wing Southern Poverty Law Center is one of the greatest offenders on this front with their program titled Teaching Tolerance. This program is designed to infiltrate schools with radically progressive education resources that undermine Christian values about marriage and family. FRC's brochure outlines the content within the SPLC's Teaching Tolerance Project and empowers parents to protect their children against the SPLC's agenda. Learn more at frc.org/teachingtolerance. That's frc.org/teachingtolerance.
You're listening to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along. The Washington Post is reporting that the abortion giant Planned Parenthood's brand of sexual health care, and health care is definitely in quotes, will soon be within the halls of dozens of California public schools, and Los Angeles taxpayers get to foot the bill. Joining me now is Petrina Mosley. She's FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy. We're going to talk about that subject. Welcome back to Washington Watch, Petrina.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us the story. What's going on in good old California with Planned Parenthood?
Oh, California and Planned Parenthood. That has been in too many sentences for a very, very long time, and it is now more than obvious that they are in bed together. California and Planned Parenthood, they seem to support each other like white on rice. And right now we've just seen California pass a mandate that would force all 34 of their public universities to dispense the abortion pill. And now, as of December, Planned Parenthood is planning on going into the high schools. So right now they have 50 locations that they plan on being in throughout the Los Angeles County, where they want to be the ones to bring wellness to their sexual reproductive health studies there at the schools. I don't know about you, but I don't trust Planned Parenthood to talk about sexual reproductive health.
Well, you know, one of their marketing campaigns that they were trying to push for a while there, and they had these big banners up on outside their facilities, it said something like health care is found here or something like that. And really, Planned Parenthood doesn't do much in terms of health care. They have a very, very, very limited scope, and it's pretty much in the reproductive area. They don't do, you know, they talk about mammograms. They've, as far as I know, they've never owned a mammogram machine. They refer for that kind of thing. So they have a limited, very limited health care. If you were, you know, if you're sick you typically say, I'm sick, I've got such and such. You usually go to your doctor for health care. If you're sick and you go to Planned Parenthood, they'll say, sorry, we don't do that. And that would be the most of the list of everything.
Right.
So the health care thing, it's a myth, everybody. They don't do health care except in a very, very limited sense of the word. Okay, you talk about 50 schools that Planned Parenthood is going to, mm-hmm. I'm going to use the word infiltrate.
Right.
What is this? What would this look like? What's it going to look like? Is there a clinic that they're going to do? Or are they going to have a little office or a room where you can come in and talk to Nurse Nancy about your reproductive health issues? What's it going to look like?
That's the gist of it. They will have centers set up within the schools called well-being centers where students can go in and talk about emergency contraception, STI testing, birth control, mental health support, pregnancy counseling, and the such. Now, when they were contemplating this idea, they said that the idea sprang forth in their minds because of the high STD rates within California high schools between the ages of 15 and 24. So they said, well, we should bring in, you know, our businesses to the schools and help these teens navigate this sexual reproductive lane. False. This is the business model. We know Planned Parenthood. We've seen them consistently only care about the abortion quota. Even when it came down to having a new Planned Parenthood president in Leanna Wen, who wanted to restructure Planned Parenthood to be a women's health center and to lower abortions, they quickly shut that down, and they made it very clear that they were about abortion quotas. And even Abby Johnson's story, a former abortion, yeah. a former Planned Parenthood worker herself, said that that was the case. The agenda was more abortions. And right now the education field is the Planned Parenthood's next target, full-blown, not just here and there, but full-blown. We've seen, like I said, in October, Governor Newsom signing the abortion pill mandate for college campuses. Now they're in the high schools. And also this is about staying alive in an era where pro-life is winning. We've seen with Title X, stricter enforcement of Title X, now that's cut out Planned Parenthood out of millions. And really, they chose not to go for the funding because they did not want to comply with Title
right.
X.
Yep.
So now there's new competition for Planned Parenthood, and they know that, and they're struggling to figure out ways they can survive, and they are trying to grab a hold of the next generation. So this is not about offering students and women and girls real solutions to sexual reproductive health, but this is about gaining new customers.
All right. I want to quote Kristen Hawkins. She's president of Students for Life of America. This is a great quote, and it kind of helps explain where Planned Parenthood is coming from. She said, Planned Parenthood has been targeting younger and younger girls through their version of sex education, and boys too, beginning as early as elementary school, which encourages people to make bad choices. That's how they make money, as they profit from creating crisis through bad choices and then selling abortions to those same students. Patrina, for years and years, this Planned Parenthood's brand of sex education, it's kind of like this. It's, you know, we know you're going to have sex, so let us show you how to do it. And then they provide contraceptives, which they know and which has been shown statistically clear that these young people, that it's going to fail. And so what that means is that there's going to be a pregnancy. When that sets them up for the next rung in the Planned Parenthood scheme, which is to sell them an abortion. So
right.
That's kind
that's
of the way that goes.
Is.
Yep.
Trying to get new customers.
Real quick, about 30 seconds, Patrina, is there any way that California parents can put a stop to this?
Right now, you need to contact your school board members and let them know that you do not condone this at all. And if need be, continue to look into Christian legal aid, like what happened with one parent who had Planned Parenthood at her middle school, her child's middle school. So there are a few options out there. We'll continue to watch this story very closely.
Very good. Patrina, thanks for your work. Appreciate your time today. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Eben Fowler, Director of Operations for Bot Radio Network, filling in for Tony today. Coming up next in our final segment is Christians. Our shopping habits should reflect wise Christian stewardship. For example, should we spend another dime at Chick-fil-A? What about other stores as we make Christmas purchases? I'll talk with Dr. David Black, founder of Second Vote, in our final segment coming right up.
News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
Oh, yeah, it sure is. Eben Fowler here with Bot Radio Network, filling in for Tony Perkins on today's Monday edition of Washington Watch. And we got some snow here in the Kansas City area. I guess there are other parts of the country that have it. So it is beginning to look a lot like Christmas. I'm not going to try to sing like that guy. You'd turn this thing off right now. As Christians, our shopping habits should reflect wise Christian stewardship. For example, should we spend another dime at Chick-fil-A? What about other stores as we make our Christmas purchases? And by the way, I want to give you an opportunity to call in a little bit later in this segment. Here's the number, 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. Here's my question. If you've been aware of what's going on with Chick-fil-A, and now, as of yesterday, Hallmark, kind of like to know what your thoughts are in terms of what you are going to do as in your family, as parents in particular, with respect to organizations like those two organizations that are starting to turn south on us in terms of the values that they uphold. We'll be talking more about those specifics, but that's the question I'd like you to keep in mind. We'll try to get you on 866-372-7234. But first, joining me now is Dr. David Black, founder of an organization called Second Vote. Dr. Black, welcome to the broadcast today.
Well, hello. Thank you very much for having me on. Appreciate the chance to speak with you.
Well, first of all, I'm going to give you an opportunity to tell our listeners what Second Vote is. I know what it is, but many listeners may not. So what do you all do?
Well, we are a research organization, and what we research is corporate social activism. And the idea is you have a vote every 2 years at the polling booth, but you also have an opportunity to vote every day with your dollar. So we track what corporations are doing with regard to the money you may spend with them, and in many instances, they may be using those dollars to fund organizations that you would not normally support.
All right. Well, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with the Chick-fil-A and Hallmark situations, could you review what has happened in both cases?
Certainly. Well, the Chick-fil-A is, of course, of great concern. Chick-fil-A has not only been a company founded and managed as a Christian organization, it has really promoted that whole foundation of their corporation to their customers over many, many years, and they've enjoyed great success. And unfortunately, what we've seen is a significant change in their philanthropy. And they are now, and it's not sudden, there's actually been in the background some changes made even prior to their recent announcement of no longer supporting the Salvation Army and Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Chick-fil-A now is funding the LGBTQ agenda, which is the homosexual agenda. And they are also funding an organization that is facilitating abortions. And they're also involved, and this is also very troubling, they're also involved in supporting sanctuary cities through some of the organizations that they're funding. So what we have is, at Second Vote, we have a five-point scoring system. One indicates direct support of a organization that would be counter to Judeo-Christian values. Two would be indirect support. Three is neutral. Four would be what Chick-fil-A was. And then a five would be typically as Judeo-Christian as any company could become.
Yeah.
And we have seven issues that we score on. And what we've just done is we have just rescored Chick-fil-A on the life issue, religious liberty, marriage, and immigration. Those are four of our seven issues. Our other issues are education, Second Amendment, and I'm forgetting something here. I think I lost track here of my seventh issue. Environmental alarmism.
Well, yeah. Well, let's stop here for a second, because I know you're going to go to the Hallmark thing in a moment. But what has happened at Chick-fil-A? They were so strong. They did so well. They withstood a lot of attacks when their founder made it clear that they stood for traditional marriage back a few years ago, and their business went through the roof. What has happened?
Well, they have brought in some senior management that are not convicted in their faith or in the Christian faith. And so there's been a change in policies over some period of time. But in terms of what really has gone on, I don't know if we will really know what's happened behind the curtain. I will say that it's extremely of interest to me that in 2004, you may recall this, Target department stores announced right at Christmas they were discontinuing allowing Salvation Army kettles and ringers out in front of all of their department stores.
Right.
And now we have the same event happening here at Chick-fil-A right at the Christmas time, and also Hallmark. And I don't think this is a coincidence. I think this is the time of the year in which the LGBTQ agenda would like to make its point that they are able to influence these organizations. And that is indeed what has happened. Now, we do have another aspect of this. I don't know, this could be totally pure speculation, but you know the Southern Poverty Law Center is in the business of declaring Christian organizations a hate group.
Right.
And the consequence to that is big money people like J.P. Morgan or SunTrust will withdraw any opportunity for funding with them for growth or for business growth. And I don't know if there was any implicit or implied threat to Chick-fil-A. Certainly as a successful company, they still have to borrow money for growth. I don't know. It's very puzzling. This is contrary to everything we've understood about Chick-fil-A.
Yeah. Now, what seems odd, too, is that Chick-fil-A has just grown by leaps and bounds. I think they're the number three in sales in the entire country. You know, how much growth do they really need? They've got enough stores. You could stop right now with expansion of Chick-fil-A and still have a great, viable business. But apparently they think that they need more money. Hopefully in a few minutes here, we're going to talk to a couple of our listeners about what they are personally deciding to do. But before we do that, talk about the Hallmark situation, David.
Yeah, Hallmark, again, this is LGBTQ driven. And, of course, the obvious thing is about the commercial that shows the two females kissing. And this is, again, driven by an agenda that is upending traditional marriage, traditional, well, not just traditional, factual understanding of sexuality. And the Hallmark is much like Chick-fil-A. They have really enjoyed a strong, faithful following of Christians. They have produced family products, but the influence of the LGBTQ community is significant, and it's tremendous. And you also have, of course, they're manufacturing these products in Hollywood or in settings in which a lot of the participants are advocating for diversity or inclusion or whatever language they may use, when in fact their inclusion or the diversity is always to the exclusion of the Christian faith and the Christian approach, but also the natural science and the natural fact of man that there are only two sexes. And that,
that's right.
56 genders is a mythical discussion. That's not reality.
Talking with Dr. David Black, the founder of Second Vote, and that's Second Vote, that's 2ndvote.com. You can get more information there. David, let's just take a moment to take a call from one of our listeners. Becky is calling from South Carolina, and she's a former Chick-fil-A customer. Becky, tell us what you're doing with your family and why.
Hello?
Yeah, Becky, go right ahead.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I was saying I had the app, and I was there's like three different things. It's like a silver, I don't know, bronze, silver, gold. I think one of them's red, whatever. I was almost at the top. That's how much money I spent at Chick-fil-A. My children love Chick-fil-A. We went there almost every day, every other day. Ever since I found out they dropped their Christian values and did not stand for God and just went left, I have not set foot near there, have not spent any money there, and I do not plan on spending any more money there. My daughter actually read a book about the founder of Chick-fil-A, and we were, you know, we loved how he was a Christian and he stood for Christian values. They were closed on Sundays. And then for his son who took over whatever to do this, I was shocked. But yeah, they will not be getting any more of my money.
Well, so how did you explain to your children the change? And I don't know what the ages are, but how have you walked through that?
Well, they're young. I have a 4-year-old, an 8-year-old, and my oldest is almost 12. So they just, I haven't really told them exactly why yet, because I haven't even had, like, you know, sexual talks with any of my children yet. But they just know that Chick-fil-A was not standing up to the Christian values, so we don't do business there anymore.
Very good. Well, Becky, thanks for calling in. We appreciate it. Well, Dr. Black, what do you think Christian families should be considering with respect to both Chick-fil-A? You know, it's a obviously it's a consumer-driven decision, and Hallmark, not only their productions that you watch on television, but they have stores all over the place. What are your recommendations and your thoughts in terms of how families should engage with these issues?
Well, I think that as Christians, we need to make sure that the money we are spending is not going to a place that is attacking our very faith and our very values. And unfortunately, it's taken many years, decades, for us to find ourselves in this position and in this condition. I think not only do we need to watch where we spend our money, but we need to speak up. We need to communicate to these companies that we're not happy, we're dissatisfied. I mean, Chick-fil-A is something you can readily make a choice on. You don't have to eat a Chick-fil-A. There are many other options. Wendy's is a good option. But what we always recommend, too, is shop local. You oftentimes have local small sandwich shops or burger places or where you can also buy a product. Now, Hallmark, obviously, they depend upon viewership. That viewership then drives their advertising. But you can speak up to Hallmark, but you can speak up to their advertisers, too, to JCPenney, to Campbell's Soup, to the companies that are advertising on their channel, and tell them that you don't appreciate what Hallmark is now showing, which is advocating for a reality that is not true. It doesn't exist, but it's also causing great harm to our children. The LGBTQ community is they're very busy at trying to tell our children that sexuality is a choice, that you can choose one of these 56 genders, and that is who you can be whoever you can imagine yourself to be. I refer to this as unicorns. It's like saying you're a unicorn. You're not a unicorn. You're who you are. But we're seeing great harm done to the psychology and the mentality and the mental state of our children over this.
Absolutely.
This is something we have to address as Christians.
The LGBTQ, I can't even get all the initials right, and I keep adding them, but they're a very, very small percentage of the population. Why do they have so much leverage? Why is it that companies like Chick-fil-A, and, well, I can understand Hallmark, because, as you said, a lot of the production is done in Hollywood, and Hollywood's values are a mess for the most part, with the exception of a few folks that are working hard there. But why is it that this little tail is wagging the dog in so many cases?
Well, it's because they're very well organized. They may be a small minority, but they are very well organized. They're very, very well financed. They have spent many, many years, decades of presenting themselves through television situation comedies, through movies, as not only normal, but they're usually portrayed as the smartest, funniest person in the room. Hollywood has done an incredible job, and New York media have done their part, but there's been this sustained, well-financed, well-organized effort to try to show that this is okay, that this is normal. And I think it's that most Christians are busy working, raising their families, maybe building a business. And most folks are trying to live their lives, but in the background, what is going on is a very directed effort to create this mythical world where there are all these different genders. You can choose who you wish to be. You can be one gender on Monday and a different gender on Tuesday. And we as Christians have been tolerant. We've been accepting. We've tried to be understanding. But make no doubt about it, the goal of the LGBTQ community is to destroy Christianity, to destroy Scripture, to destroy the design of the world. They want us all to believe that there's this mythical reality that a man can be married to a man or a woman can be married to a woman. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as a marriage between a man and a man or a woman and a woman. It's make-believe. It's like children playing. It's not reality.
Well, you know, then the question is, what can we do? As believers, what can we do? Certainly, we should be going to your website, secondvote.com, to see where different companies score, and then we should use our dollars. And of course, you know, the individual thinks, well, I don't have much power. I don't spend a whole lot at Chick-fil-A or wherever else it might be. What difference am I going to make? Can you address that here in the last minute or two?
Well, absolutely. Look what the LGBTQ community has done with 3% or less of the population. But also at Second Vote, we have helped to stop five Fortune 500 companies from funding abortion. We have helped make changes in corporations. There are others that are doing such work. Obviously, FRC, AFA, and many other organizations are working at this. We can make a difference. The problem with the Christian community and conservatives is we haven't spoken up. We've been quiet. And
David,
and time again, I hear that excuse me.
Yeah, David, we're out of time. Thanks for the work that you do at Second Vote, and I would encourage our listeners to take a look at that website and take action as families, as parents. Well, that wraps up another edition of Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Thanks so much for listening to the Monday edition.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.